If it's Thursday, 6 p.m., that means it's time for Perspectives by John Pierce. Welcome to Perspectives on WDIY Allentown. I'm John Pierce, your host. Glad to have you along. And our engineer is James Zibrot. Our topic this evening, we are having two of our guests return to our microphones to talk about the unthinkable, which happened in 2001 when Bethlehem Steel declared bankruptcy after nearly a century and a half of making iron and steel. Now, my guests, I should say, are John Landis, father, and Stephen Landis, son. And I love the fact that it's a father-son collaboration on this book. It's a beautiful book, 96 pages. The publisher, America Through Time, and it's from 2023. Very useful little book to show you what Bethlehem Steel was, because the title is Bethlehem Steel, Rusting Relic. Well, Steve Landis, by the way, John, I have to ask you the crucial question here. Stephen is spelled with a V, not yes. a PH.
Yes.
When you and your wife had a beautiful, bouncing baby boy, what was the determination of V instead of PH?
My wife is Jewish, and we decided we would not use the British PH, but instead the V.
Oh, so the PH is British.
It tends to be more British, okay. Yes. So, but either way is fine. We mostly call our son Steve, and right. I think that's what he likes the
best.
And that is, in fact, with a V.
Yeah. All right. There we go. So Stephen Landis is the photographer in this collaboration, and he had rare sanctioned access to photograph. I love the way, Steve, you say sanctioned access, you know. So our listeners don't think that you sneaked in at midnight and took pictures you weren't supposed to.
That's correct. I did not.
sanctioned access to photograph the derelict plant, capturing incredible photography of many never before seen and likely never to be seen again perspectives by climbing everything he could. Now, Steve is also a mountain climber, right? You like to climb the rocks, take chances.
I do.
You're carrying a very expensive camera on your back.
Yes. Yep. Trying to get that, amazing vantage point.
Not for the faint of heart.
I guess not.
Both inside and outside the abandoned buildings, including the top of the blast furnaces. Now, the blast furnaces, for those who have driven by and seen or been to an event, maybe a music event of some sort at the steel stacks, what we now call the steel stacks, those are the blast furnaces, the steel stacks.
Yes, I think that's what they consider it to be. It's kind of a misnomer. The furnaces themselves are what we'd like to think of as vessels within vessels. The inside is refractory brick that is the way that the outside steel didn't get touched by the pig iron that was being made inside. Had the pig iron touched the outside, it would have fused to it and damaged the vessel. But they call the entire area steel stacks, so it's not that much of a misnomer. It's the alliteration of steel stacks,
right.
Of course, is good.
Exactly, and the superstructure that people would notice right away are the blast furnaces.
That's correct. It's really the icon of a steel mill.
Right, and there are five of them left.
There are five, exactly.
Right,
yes.
And before there were seven. Altogether.
Yes. That's correct. Yes.
Two of them, there were fires, explosions.
1948 March, there was an explosion, and that's why we don't have furnaces F and G. And they lay in ruins until the 1960s, and then they were cleaned up, furnaces F and G, and the area was made into a parking lot, which it is today.
Well, let me say that I'm from the Chicago area, and the only reason that I would have known as a child that Bethlehem, Pennsylvania existed was Bethlehem Steel. I knew the name of Philadelphia. I knew the name of Pittsburgh. I didn't know Allentown. And believe it or not, I didn't even know Macungie.
But
but I knew Bethlehem by the company, by the steel. Yes. The steel, as you like to say.
Exactly.
Yes, so I'm reading from the back of this book called Bethlehem Steel, Rusting Relic. And here it says, viewers will find that when combined with his artistic eye, Stephen's camera work truly elevates Bethlehem Steel photography. And his dad subsequently became an historic Bethlehem Museums and Sites tour guide in 2019 and began showing these photographs. So it's true. When you do your tours, John, you have some of these, I think, 8x10 color pictures that Steve took, and you have them in one ring of what would be possibly a three-ring binder. It's just one ring. And then you flip them off and say, and this one was one of the steel stacks that was over there once upon a time and whatnot. It's very well done as a tour, so I highly recommend it to folks. What are the tour days and times that you do tours?
We do tours Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday at 1 p.m., and the tour lasts about an hour and a half, and we do that every week. I usually do one or two tours over a weekend, but we do have four.
And people should dress accordingly because you're mostly outdoors.
It is entirely an outdoor tour, yes. So dress according to the weather that's perceived of for that day.
Right. So after all the work with photos and research and having done many tours, what is your overall impression of Bethlehem Steel?
I feel that we had our flaws, but Bethlehem Steel was a positive and a progressive influence upon America. We connected people with bridges and railroad rail that we made. We advanced culture and commerce and education with the buildings that our steel went into. We helped to win two world wars, and we made the steel that went into countless consumer products. And so I sometimes like to end my tours by saying, we're gone today, but America should be glad we happened.
How about Stephen?
Yeah, it's, you know, to build off of what he was saying, it's during your tours, you always end up saying, you know, from coast to coast, right? So it's what, George Washington Bridge in New York, all the way out to Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, you know, and everywhere in between. Everywhere you look, there's more and more that you learn about Bethlehem Steel and how much of a heavy influence they had during, even, you know, it wasn't named that at the time, but even back to Civil War and then during the two World Wars, consumer goods, you know, from tin cans, which are really, as my dad says, you know, steel with tin plating, sheet metal. We were just learning earlier this week, there was a gentleman that we talked with from Mack Trucks, and he said he remembers, you know, deliveries on a regular basis of sheet steel, you know, coming in from Bethlehem Steel for Mack Trucks. And so, you know, automobiles, heavy trucks, my dad was mentioning the railroad rail, buildings, the list goes on. And just a amazing influence and, you know, definitely built and protected the world that we know.
Right. So you mentioned coast to coast, and right in the book, mentioning Merchandise Mart in Chicago, and that as a child I learned was the largest building of square feet in Chicago. It's a huge building.
It is, yes.
Merchandise Mart. And then how about the Washington, D.C. Supreme Court building?
Yes.
That's another one.
And may I add one to the bridges, about as far east as you can get, the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. We have our steel in the center section of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. So literally as far east to as far west as you can get in this country.
Wow. And in Pittsburgh, let's give a shout out to the Pittsburghers, the Cathedral of Learning, which is an iconic building there.
Correct. Cathedral of Learning is University of Pittsburgh's, I would say, primo building, and yet it is Bethlehem Steel in that building.
Okay. Now, John and Steve, tell me if this is hyperbole. In the 1940s, nearly 80% of the New York skyline was built with steel that Bethlehem made.
No, it's not hyperbole. The center core of the Empire State Building is Bethlehem Steel. Madison Square Garden, Rockefeller Plaza, Lincoln Center, the watertight steel casings in Lincoln Tunnel, Waldorf Astoria.
Whoa.
They're all Bethlehem Steel.
Yes. So this great company that flourished, you say, during the Second World War and then maybe a decade or two afterwards, came to an end at about 1995?
Yes, we had what we called our last heat. It was the last time we made pig iron. It was in Furnace C, a very emotional ceremony. A lot of workers who had given their entire lives to Bethlehem Steel knew that we were on the decline, because if we weren't making pig iron any longer in our blast furnaces, we weren't going to be making steel. And nothing would be going out the door to the customer, ultimately. And so we were on a decline, but it was not till 2001 that we actually declared bankruptcy.
So between 1995 and 2001.
Yes.
And this great company came crashing down, should we say. Now, we're going to have to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about some reasons. How could such a great company that produced steel, which was such a necessary commodity, especially when we talk about two world wars, and then bridges and prominent buildings across the country, how could that company have to declare bankruptcy? We're going to go into some of those reasonings with Stephen and John Landis when we continue. Hang in there, folks, and we'll be back in just a minute on Perspectives with John Pierce and with our engineer, James Zibrot. WDIY, Allentown.
Unlimited possibilities, folk music from across the Atlantic to the Lehigh Valley. Songs from this country's roots to the songs of today.
Oh, baby, I'm getting ready.
The Carter family to Joan Baez, Patty Griffin to John Gorka. There's always a great variety on Unlimited Possibilities. Friday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY Allentown.
And we're back talking about Bethlehem Steel. The book that we are highlighting is now in its third printing, printed originally in 2023. Title is Bethlehem Steel Rusting Relic, written by Stephen M. Landis and John K. Landis, father and son, and published by America Through Time. And Stephen's going to give us a little taste of the writing here. Stephen?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, so this is actually a part of the introduction to the book. Just to give you a little bit of perspective about how this project came about. Twice in 2006, I joined a small group that obtained authorization to visit the former Bethlehem Steel plant in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. These were incredible experiences for me. Growing up in the 1980s and 1990s, I had seen, smelled, heard, and felt Bethlehem Steel when it was still operational. It teemed with life from thousands of workers operating around the clock. The plant itself also appeared to be its own living thing, as it inhaled vast loads of taconite, coke, and limestone, belched a pall of smoke and ash, poured out train car loads of glowing molten iron, and for nearly a century and a half made iron and steel for bridges, buildings, dams, railroad rail, ships, armor plating, armaments, and a huge variety of other products that created and protected the world we know. Walking and climbing among the ruins of the shuttered plant, I could still feel the energy there. Some areas retained an appearance of the workers only being on a lunch break, ready to return to their jobs at any moment. Other areas of the plant were already showing heavy signs of dilapidation after being abandoned only a decade earlier. And that's just in reference to 1995, as my dad was saying, so that was the last cast hot end operation for the Bethlehem plant. The entire site for me held an air of veiled sorrow, of missed opportunity, and of what ifs. But within this rusting relic of American industry, I also saw overwhelming beauty in the duality of decay and stubborn perseverance of some of the structures as they were slowly being reclaimed by nature. I felt awestruck by the memories and lessons the plant continues to evoke, even in its derelict condition. My dad began offering steel tours for historic Bethlehem museums and sites in 2019, after retiring from a nearly 40-year career of university teaching and working in the communication design industry. He asked me for my photographs of the Bethlehem steel plant as visuals for his tour groups that would never be authorized access to the abandoned buildings or blast furnaces, instead only walking around a fenced outer perimeter. Considerable sections of the former plant are now altogether gone and have been replaced by a casino, a hotel, restaurants, shopping, and an entertainment complex. Joining one of my dad's tours and enjoying the show, as the large group clung to his every word and huddled tightly to see 8x10 prints of my photographs in a portfolio that he held up, that inspired me to create the book, Bethlehem Steel, Rusting Relic.
And that was Stephen Landis, photographer. So I'm going to turn to John now. We have this great company rolling along, mid-20th century, and actually founded way back in the 19th century. And then comes the demise. What happened?
Well, times were changing in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. During the Second World War and the post-war era, top management at Bethlehem Steel knew that times were good, but thought they would never not be good. Yet the times were changing badly. There was less demand for steel as we got toward the end of the last century. There were alternate products that steel was needed less. We had aluminum. We had pre-stressed concrete. We had plastics. These things replaced steel in some cases. There were also new methods for producing steel that top management was not keeping up with as well as they should have. A couple of those new methods that were very significant were the electric arc furnace, which basically circumvents making steel from making iron first. The electric arc furnace takes scrap steel, melts it down, and out comes new steel. And what used to take 10 man-hours to make a ton of steel the way we did it, the old way, making iron first, processing it into steel, today takes 1/2 man-hour.
Wow.
And also the continuous casting equipment that we should have had more of. It basically does not use a rigid ingot that gets heated up and made into a shape, whatever the customer needs. In the case of continuous casting, it's molten steel that comes from a reservoir called a tundish, and that gets shaped, and an indeterminate length can be produced. It's much faster, it's a higher quality control, and we should have had more electric arc furnaces and more continuous casters. We also didn't have a very efficient operation. Our plant ultimately was 4.5 miles long, strung along the Lehigh River, and it was narrow in some cases. And being an old Northeast city, any time we would need to have some new process for the steelmaking, we would find a place to put a building, sometimes squeeze it in, and we ended up with 400 miles of in-plant railroad track in order to move the product back and forth before it went out the door to the customer. Whereas the new plants, what they called mini mills, very often they were very simple in their operation, not because they were small, but because of the simplicity, using electric arc furnaces, continuous casting, and so forth. They could have a straight line operation. And they were built in Deep South, Arkansas, Alabama, in some cases, the flattened ruins of war in Europe and Asia in other cases. And the operation was straight line as opposed to ours. The ultimate thing that did us in was not a tangible thing, a little harder to understand. But when we would close a plant or we would sell off some mine or quarry somewhere, we were very independent. We owned the mine. We owned the quarry. We owned 9 short line railroads. We owned an ocean-going shipping line. We owned a trucking line. We did it all, and we were very proud of that fact. But as we started to go downhill, and these entities were not making the revenue for us they once were, they became burdensome overhead. And so we would close a plant, and we'd say, well, now we don't have to pay those people their wages, but they would immediately go on pensions and benefits. Toward the very end of our existence, we had 11,500 people working nationwide, 11,500 total. And we had 120,000 on pensions and benefits. The system was upside down, and we couldn't pay our pensions. And that was the ultimate thing that did us in.
And so bankruptcy was declared.
2001, yes. And then we sold our remaining assets to International Steel Group in 2003, and we were literally off the map.
Wow. Well, I wish we had a better ending to...
Well, we do have a good ending in the sense that we came back strong on the south side, Bethlehem.
All right. How so?
We had help from various sources. We had visionaries in the mayor, the city council, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We also had a casino. In those days, it was Sands. Today, it's Wind Creek. And they bought for us 126 acres, put their own casino, of course, and hotels on it and outlets and restaurants. But they gave us, if you will, the blast furnaces and a number of outbuildings, and we're the custodians of them, basically. And so we have tourism on the south side. We have an ice rink. We have a banana factory, art studios and galleries. We have great shops and restaurants, and, of course, a university and a community college. So we have... become strong once again.
Yeah, I like to call it the eclectic Southside Bethlehem.
So true.
Certainly.
So true, yes.
We have not yet mentioned Martin Tower. What about that? What can we say about that? Did you take any pictures over there, Steve?
I did. Limited, but I have one photo in the book of Martin Tower. It's, off in the distance, but you can see it, still standing and... unfortunately, not any longer. So it's a memorial photo in the book.
Yeah, it was imploded.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes, it was. We in 1972, we moved our top executives from a 1916 building, which still stands, interestingly, to Martin Tower, a couple miles north, $35 million high-rise steel building. But when we went out of business for a while, we had a couple of tenants in the building. But the building had asbestos in it and needed a sprinkler system. And so, unfortunately, we couldn't go ahead with some of the things that it might have been good for, hotel, condos, whatever. And so April of 2019, we imploded that building. And the building that gets the last laugh is the 1916 building.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yes.
And tell us about why the 1916 building is an H shape.
Well, top management wanted corner offices.
Yes,
and the way to get the corner offices, if you picture an H shape, was to have the shape front and back that the building still looks like today if you drive past it, And even when Martin Tower was built, it was built in a plus sign, a cross shape. So again, as many corner offices as possible. And in the case of Martin Tower, the tallest building, the highest view in the Lehigh Valley. So yes, that's the reason.
And one thing that happened, John, when they moved the executives from the building on Southside Bethlehem to Martin Tower, was it moved the executives farther from the laborers.
It's true. That's true.
And from the work itself. Seems to me psychologically maybe not such a smart move.
Interesting point. I had not thought of that, but you're so right. It was several miles away.
Yeah. It reminds me of what I heard about the big automakers when they started to have their problems. And then you heard about a skyscraper in Detroit that might have the executives up on, I'm making it up now, but the 12th or 13th floor, and they were removed from the automaking itself. Mm. Sort of a symbol of a spread between employees, because they're all employees. But whether that contributed to the demise?
Perhaps. Just seems like wouldn't have your finger on the pulse quite as much as you would have had you been right on the property, which the top executives were originally.
Right. Before we leave, I must mention that one of my regrets in life is not having been creative enough to come up with the title for our minor league baseball team here in the Lehigh Valley, which is the Iron Pigs.
Yes.
And, of course, this goes back to Bethlehem Steel days. And I salute whoever it is out there who came up with the name, because it allows the team to promote itself in so many different ways. I like to call them the Piggies. And then they have all these promotions about bacon and whatnot. So the Iron Pigs.
When I tell my people on my tour that pig iron is what comes out of the blast furnaces. We're not the steel yet, but it's pig iron. And I say the expression is used around the world. It's not ours, but we have something that is ours, the baseball team, AAA baseball team, and that's the Iron Pigs. That belongs to us, but the concept of pig iron is around the world.
There it is. Well, Stephen Landis and John Landis, my guests this evening, thanks so much for coming to our WDIY microphones for the second time and talking about Bethlehem Steel Rusting Relic. That's the title of their book. It's in its third printing, so congratulations to you both on that.
Thank you.
And look forward to seeing you sometime in the future.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So, dear listeners, thanks for tuning in. Thank you, James Zibrot, for your great work as our engineer. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.